Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, a show where we speak to the top thought leaders in health innovation, health policy, care delivery, and the great minds who are shaping the healthcare of the future. This week in our Best of 2019 show, Mark and Margaret look back at a year of policy giants, innovators in the healthcare space, clinicians turned activists against public health injustices, and our luminary guests who are making a true difference across the healthcare spectrum. They highlight their conversation with Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha, the Flint, Michigan pediatrician who sounded the alarm on the Flint water crisis, and Matthew Meyer, CEO of Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids, with chilling information on the industry-driven vaping crisis. Policy giants like House Majority Whip James Clyburn and policy activists like former CMS Administrator Andy Slavin. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook, Twitter, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can also hear us by asking Alexa to play the program Conversations on Healthcare. Now, stay tuned for our Best of 2019 edition here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, 2019, we're almost at the end of it.
Yeah.
10 years on the radio.
Amazing.
It was great to celebrate with all of our various luminaries that we've had on the show and to realize that we had done 500 shows in that time. And this time of the year, we always like to take a moment and reflect on the guests that we had on the show this year.
There were definitely moments that stood out this year, and certainly one for me was one of our true public health heroes, Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha. She's the pediatrician who first really observed the spike in lead poisoning and elevated lead levels that she was seeing in children in her practice in Flint, and she made the connection to a change that was brought about by city leaders changing the source of the water supply, and in the process really set off just a public health and I would say a humanitarian and social justice crisis in that community. And she organized leadership and she brought that community together, really stands as a marker for people of how they can organize when there's a public health crisis in a community. So very powerful.
You know, from the moment that we recognized that we had this population-wide lead exposure, we knew that our next step was secondary prevention. You know, we failed at preventing this exposure, but we were working around the clock to make sure that we didn't see the consequences of this exposure. We also had an outbreak of Legionnaires' disease. We had massive skin issues. But by and large, it was a crisis of betrayal and loss of trust. And all of those emotions, as we know as clinicians, also can lead to poor outcomes. So, you know, science was denied in this crisis. You know, ultimately, it was our science that spoke truth to power. And we have been committed to using the science of child development, of brain plasticity, of resilience to buffer the impact of this crisis. And that's what this pediatric public health initiative is all about. It's this holistic approach to mitigating the impact of this crisis and using everything we know to promote the development of children. Things like expansion of home visiting programs, literacy promotion, breastfeeding services, Medicaid expansion. We have also just launched something called the Flint Registry. The goal of this registry is to identify those exposed, but most importantly, to get them connected to these development-promoting interventions to improve their outcomes. And this is one of the ways where we hope to share what we are doing with other communities, because the story of Flint is not isolated. There are kids everywhere waking up to the same toxicities of lead exposure or poverty or injustice or lost democracy or austerity or violence. And what we want to share is how we've been able to turn the story around and improve the outcomes of our children.
Speaking of public health crises, this year, the vaping crisis really took hold. We had Matthew Myers, who joined the show, CEO for the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids, talking about the spike in nicotine addiction due to the vaping craze. And companies are selling candy-flavored e-cigarettes. I think we've heard a couple
some
of people who have started to ban it.
Yeah.
Very interesting conversation. Let's hear a little from Matthew Myers.
In the last 2 years, we've seen a 135% increase in the number of kids who use e-cigarettes. Now, over 5 million kids are using e-cigarettes. The newest generation of e-cigarettes deliver such a powerful impact of nicotine that kids are becoming addicted to the product more rapidly and in many cases more intensely So we face a real public health threat. 28% of high school kids currently use e-cigarettes. And what the data doesn't show, the kids who are currently using their cigarettes are kids who never would have smoked a cigarette. We have more kids addicted to nicotine today than we've had in the last two decades. This wasn't an accident. This came about because the e-cigarette industry read and implemented the tobacco industry's old playbook. They introduced products with sweet flavors that the industry has known for decades appealed to kids. They packed it with massive amounts of nicotine. They made it cool among kids by engaging in the kind of social marketing that didn't exist when the Marlboro Man existed. And then when the public health scare became widespread, they hired more lobbyists than we can count to try to undermine efforts at reasonable, thoughtful government regulation. We're not helpless. Virtually every kid who starts using an e-cigarette uses one of those flavored products, whether it be mango or gummy bear or cotton candy. That if we prohibit the sale of any flavored e-cigarette, we can dramatically cut the number of young people who start. We can cut off that on-ramp.
We still don't know enough about the potential harm that these products are capable of. If you want more information on this topic, visit the website tobaccofreekids.org. We also have what we would call another epidemic in the unmet demand for mental health services. Lack of access to mental health in this country is huge. We had Dr. Ken Duckworth, the medical director of NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and he talked about their efforts to improve access around the country.
Yeah, NAMI advocated very intensely to get mental health parity, and it has shown an increase in accessibility and availability, and attitudes have improved towards help seeking. There has been no corresponding public health response to create more practitioners, more psychiatrists, more loan forgiveness plans that would enable people to participate. Mm-hmm. There are millions of people right now who didn't get the Medicaid expansion in their state. The people who have the Medicaid expansion are doing better per square person than the states who don't have the Medicaid expansion. Many psychiatrists are choosing not to take insurance. My experience here in Massachusetts is that master's level clinicians are very happy to take insurance. Mm-hmm. And so we have more people getting assessments and evaluations and being seen by social workers, licensed marriage family therapists than ever before. What I would encourage people to do is work with their health plan. The health plan has an obligation to give you the help you've paid for. And the health plan will pay out-of-network benefits mm-hmm. if there isn't anyone in their network. I think that's a secret that people don't really know.
You know, pulling the thread on that conversation, we also really had a wonderful conversation with Dr. Stephen Wolf,
who
was out of Virginia Commonwealth University School of Medicine. And his research showed a marked decline in life expectancy in America, and especially for working families, and really focused in on that 25 to 64 year old group. But then he talked about the deaths of despair, and boy, that phrase just grabs your heart. It's the loss of so many lives due to the opioid crisis, alcoholism, and suicides that really have reached an incredible tipping point. Let's hear a little from Dr. Wolf.
Well, it might be helpful to start just by unpacking what's behind this increase in working age mortality. Mm-hmm. So drug overdoses fueled by the opioid epidemic are the leading contributor for that increase by far. There's also been an increase in deaths from alcoholism and suicides. It was not me, actually, but other researchers who coined this term deaths of despair mm-hmm. in an attempt to try to weave together some explanation for those three causes. But our study found increases in 35 causes of death in this age group, and it extended well beyond substance abuse and suicides to include a variety of chronic diseases. So while clearly opioids and drug addiction are major priorities in trying to solve this problem, it's actually more pervasive.
Well, we really appreciated having him as the wrap up to year in the darkest and shortest days of the year coming in December. We hope it presages a brighter tomorrow.
And speaking of brighter tomorrows.
Brighter tomorrows.
We had our good friend
Tom Bodenheimer. That is always a cause. That is always cause for a smile.
He brought light.
Tom has inspired generations of people in healthcare to rethink how we think about healthcare, how we think about the role of people in healthcare, and how we think about teams and teaching people to work together in teams, and perhaps most importantly, to go upstream to prevention wherever we can. He is really a legendary person in our circle of admired heroes, and we were thrilled to have him on.
So let's just take a particular issue. Like, say, let's take colorectal cancer screening, which we know reduces the rate and increases the longevity of people, you know, who are going to get colon cancer. So it's a very, very important thing that all primary care practices should pay attention to. All of their patients over the age of 50 get regular colorectal cancer screening. So the first thing you have to do is to measure it to see how you're doing. So if you have a good IT system, as you do, you can measure that for all your patients and you can see how you're doing over time. But then you also have to drill it down, not just to your whole organization, but to each team so you can compare how different teams are doing. Then you have to drill it down to each clinician to see how their patients are doing. So when we talk about data in the building blocks, which is one of the foundational building blocks, we don't just say data, we say data used for improvement. So how do you use the data for improvement? Well, you talk about it in the team. So, okay, our colorectal cancer screening rate's only 45%. Our goal is 80% by like the end of this year. How are we going to get from 45% to 80%? One organization that does data better than any other I see in this University of North Carolina Family Medicine Residency Clinic in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. So they have data on all these things. They drill the data down to the teams. They drill the data down to each provider. And all the data is up on the walls. Everyone knows what everyone else's data is. It's all transparent. Mm-hmm. So you know what all the other physicians, how their continuity rate is, how their access is, how their colorectal cancer screening, how their diabetes rates are. But the other thing is they want to make sure that all of their patients are offered to get colorectal cancer screening. So each team has a whiteboard up right above where the team is working. And the whiteboard says, today there are 6 patients coming in who are overdue for colorectal cancer screening. Mm-hmm. These are their names. So make sure the medical assistants who do this, make sure that you really work with those 6 patients. And then at the end of the day, they say, we got 5 out of the 6. Yeah. We still have one more to get. So it's really taking the data and like making it very patient specific to really make sure that every single patient has all of these things that they should do to keep healthy.
Well, Tom speaks for himself. What an incredible professional, and as you said earlier, a great friend. And we were so glad to hear from him. And while we had that joy, we also had some sadness this year.
We did. And you can't wrap up a year without thinking about the people who are no longer with us. And certainly on the list of heroes that we admire was Dr. Fitzhugh Mullen, a really beloved friend, mentor, colleague, and source of inspiration, certainly for myself and so many of us in healthcare. Fitzhugh passed away recently. He actually had lived with a diagnosis of cancer in his 30s, lived well into his 70s, didn't slow down, but he had made his work in the last decade or so of his life to restore social mission, particularly in medicine, but invited in people from all the disciplines and professions to help him with that work. And we will remember Fitz and honor his legacy for years to come.
Indeed, Margaret, we will miss Fitzhugh. And we also were honored to have some real important health transformers on our show. And one was Dr. Tom DelBianco, who's a primary care expert at Harvard Medical School. And he opened something called Open Notes a decade ago. And it was a pretty radical idea that he had at the
time. Everyone said it wouldn't work.
Everyone said it wouldn't work. And he thought, what if primary care provider notes were made available to their patients, letting them have access to their full record? And he began this experiment with lots of pushback, as you said, from the industry.
Patients could not be trusted.
They could not be trusted with their own information, even though they own it.
Yeah.
But it really blossomed into this great global movement. I think now some 40 million patients, including ours at Community Health Center, are available to our patients. They can go home and go through the portal and see their notes and make comments on it. And also, I think one of the things he said was people's outcomes improve.
That's
because
right.
oftentimes you walk out of that engagement, that conversation, don't remember anything that happened.
Absolutely.
But you can go back, look at the notes, and follow the plan that you've agreed on with your primary care provider. So that was really exciting.
Very few studies yet, and we may never have studies that show differences in clinical outcomes. What we do have is much, much more data replicated from many centers now. We have 200 centers, more than 200 centers involved with OpenNotes. Extraordinarily similar reports from patients and doctors about their experiences with OpenNotes. We did do one study in which we were able to compare patients with OpenNotes to patients without OpenNotes in the way that they refilled their medicines if they had high blood pressure. And we were gratified to see that those who actually had access to their notes, we don't know whether they read them or not, had higher refill rates of their medicines than those who did not have access. That's the only really formal outcome study that we have so far. On the other hand, we have institutions trying things, trying little pilots and saying, we're going to do this. It's the right thing to do, and it's useful for our patients, and it's useful for us. We have many, many anecdotes about patient safety. Two eyes on one chart are better than two eyes on 1,000 charts. And when you've got a patient reviewing his or her record and saying, there's a mistake here, it's the left knee, not the right knee. I missed that lump, or the doctor missed that lump. I was supposed to follow through on it. Or that lesion on my back, which may be precancerous. We have many rather exciting and sobering anecdotes now in the patient safety arena, which says this really increases safety. We think it's a very important part of it. We also, with medications and adherence to medications, we just published a paper in the last few weeks in the Annals of Internal Medicine showing that patients say very firmly that they're understanding their medicines better, and that 15 to maybe 40% of patients say they're taking their medicines more effectively. It costs our nation $300 billion a year to have poor adherence to medications. And if you do a little bit of math and you extrapolate to more patients reading their notes, that to me as a doctor is maybe the most exciting finding we have so far.
And for all those people who've ever gone home and their partners said to them, what did your provider say? And they said, I don't know. We think we solved that problem. But you know, Mark, I go back to the early days of the show and remember the unbelievable excitement, optimism, energy that there was around feeling that we were finally on the precipice of achieving, and really did achieve a giant step forward towards making healthcare a right and not a privilege. Mm-hmm. And that was through the creation and then the legislating and the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, as that was going on right at that very beginning. It was a pretty extraordinary time and has accomplished so much. And we wanted the smartest people that we could find to come help us understand. Yep. And we had so many people who played a role in creating the Affordable Care Act come and join us. Just as we speak, literally, mandates are again under fire. There's worries that the whole Affordable Care Act could really be
the Fifth District's
ruling, continuing to take those big hits. But one of the law's champions, former CMS Administrator Andy Slavitt, joined us recently to talk about where the law stands now.
Yeah, but one thing we do know is that millions of Americans have received coverage because of the expansion of insurance on Medicaid and through the exchanges. And that's made a profound difference in people's health and well-being, and also economic well-being.
That's right.
Because so many people were put into bankruptcy without having health insurance. So let's hear
from... That's not opinion. That's fact, evidence-based.
And let's hear from Andy now.
What's different about asking the question now, you know, 5 years after the ACA is rolled out, is we actually have data. We actually have facts that we can point to. And what we've seen across the country in pretty large numbers is reductions in premature deaths in the tens of thousands, reductions in cancer, early diagnosis of cancer, reductions in heart rates, reduction in disparities between African Americans and whites, which is sort of amazing.
Yeah.
Increase in home ownership, reduction in payday lending, increase in rural hospital ownership. So a lot of these big, broad outcomes, which shouldn't be surprising to us if what we're really doing is saying that there are people who are of marginal income who were not able to afford insurance before. And let's face it, insurance is expensive. Healthcare is expensive. And once they get it, they get a measure of protection. So, you know, we know the numbers, 20 million more people are insured. and all that, and there's all those good outcomes. On another level, I think, you know, there's been a psychological change as well in this country. The bargain for the American public used to be, if you get sick or if you can't afford coverage, that's just too bad. And that has changed to, it doesn't matter if you've ever been sick before, if you've got a pre-existing condition, if you lose your job, if you change jobs, you'll still be able to get healthcare coverage. That's a dramatic change. Okay. It used to work designed to work for insurance companies, and people had to wrap their lives around that. Now, it's supposed to work for people. Insurance companies are supposed to wrap their lives around it. Now, it's not perfect. Any major piece of legislation, we would hope, should get it about 80% right. Then the next responsible thing to do is you say, okay, well, after a few years, what are the things that worked? What are the things that didn't work? Let's take the things that didn't work and let's adjust them. And I think the major political disappointment with the ACA is that Congress just refused to act on any of the things that it saw that it could have fixed. Not only that, it actually tried to make political hay out of anything it found that was wrong, and tried to use that to repeal the entire law, including the good parts. And that's just not the way we've historically governed in this country, because we're not going to get it perfectly right. And there are people who health insurance is too expensive for, and it's unaffordable. And there are bills that are, you know, in the Congress right now, if Congress chose to act on them, I'll point to one by Representative Lauren Underwood that would actually cut premiums in half for people who are making up to $150,000, and it would cover 3 or 4 million more people. It's a really good bill. It's a common sense bill.
Well, as you said, we'll be continuing to watch what happens in 2020 mm-hmm. with the Affordable Care Act and all the legal issues around it. But we really had somebody who just reminded us about the longevity of battles that go on. When we had Congressman James Clyburn, who is the House Majority Whip from South Carolina, who came on and talked about his long career in health and in civil rights and the impact that it's had on who he is as an individual. He talked about the Affordable Care Act as a civil rights act of the 21st century, and he really just shared an incredible amount of wisdom, absolutely. And I would say joy.
Yeah.
Through all the struggles that he has such a positive outlook. Let's hear from our good friend, Representative James Clyburn.
The best thing about the Affordable Care Act, a lot of people say it's because of covering people with pre-existing conditions. That's not the best thing to me. The best thing to me was not being able to kick people off the healthcare policies once they got sick. There's another one that I think is very important, the 80-20 rule, mm-hmm. that you must return in the form of benefits to your policyholders at least 80% of the premiums. And if you don't, you have to send them a refund check. Mm-hmm. These are things about the Affordable Care Act that never get talked about. And I think they're the most important thing to be did. What we have to do is to stay engaged and be vigilant and make sure that the country doesn't go too far left or too far right. I tell people, when the pendulum is going left to right and right to left, it's passing through the center, which means that we spend twice as much time in the center as that we do to the left or to the right. Mm-hmm. So to me, that's what we have to do. Be vigilant.
So here we go. Yeah. We're launching into 2020, and the presidential election is likely to have a huge impact on health policy and the future of healthcare, along with so many things in our country. Many hats in the ring. Been really impressed with some of the debates and the attention that healthcare is getting, whatever your position is. And we have been honored to welcome some of the candidates to our show. I hope we get everybody over the coming months. And we also welcomed experts to help us understand, when people say Medicare for all, what do they mean?
That's right. And I think you're absolutely right. It was important to hear every individual's voice. And we hope to have conversations with people from all over the country, from all walks of life. And we hope our show can bring vision, it's 2020, to the issues that Americans struggle with all of the time. And we've had some really illuminating guests who've helped break down the issues. And really, you only do that when you have a conversation with somebody.
That's right. So thank you for listening. Thank you for watching when we move to a video format. We think we have a lot of great opportunity in the next year to continue to bring thought leaders and innovators to the show and to share their ideas with you. So until then,
peace and health.
Happy New Year.
You've been listening to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare is recorded at WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at chcradio.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. The show is brought to you by the Community Health Center.